If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome to a very scary edition of the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis Public Radio's terrifying political correspondent. Later in the show, we'll talk about why redistricting foes could bury a new congressional map before it can go into effect ahead of the 2026 election cycle. And we'll talk with former St. Louis County Councilwoman Kelly Dunaway about why more and more women are turning to witchcraft. First, I have to admit that I was excited to host this program on Halloween, which happens to be my favorite holiday. For the next hour, I possess unlimited power to infuse this show with references to monsters, supernatural ability, and why Three Musketeers is the best Halloween candy. And while I'd love to base segments for this show around dressing up like the internet phenomenon Smurf Cat, I'm more enamored with things that contribute to Halloween's sublime aura of spookiness. Things like curses. American politics is littered with trends or coincidences. Take, for instance, the curse of Tippecanoe, where starting with William Henry Harrison, every president who was elected in a year ending with zero eventually died in office or was assassinated. Ronald Reagan arguably broke this curse when he served out his entire 8 years, even after getting shot in 1981. So this got me thinking, what are some Missouri-based political curses, coincidences, or trends? Joining me to delve into this strange and dark world of odd political patterns is Sarah Kellogg, St. Louis Public Radio's statehouse and politics reporter. Sarah, welcome back to the show and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, Jason. Thank you for summoning me for this segment.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to keep the puns coming. So just some ground rules for this. The Missouri political curses or coincidences or patterns we'll describe, they're not going to include deaths or anything disturbing. Many of them are going to be based on elections, but we'll touch on some intriguing legislative curses too. So the first curse that comes to mind is the curse of the Missouri House Speaker's office. Since 1984, every House Speaker who tried to run for a statewide office lost. Steve Gaw lost his bid for Secretary of State in 2000. Catherine Hanaway lost bids for Secretary of State and Governor. And most recently, Dean Plocker's bid to become Secretary of State floundered badly. Hanaway, of course, was appointed Attorney General, but she won't officially break this curse unless she wins a full term in 2028. Sarah, why do you think House Speakers make for not-so-good statewide candidates?
I think there's lots of reasons, but one of them could be the prior elections that House Speakers have to go through and how that may translate statewide. So there's 163 members of the Missouri House, which means that compared to statewide or even a state Senate candidate where there's only 34 senators, that's a small area to cover and a smaller number of constituents. And there might be, you know, an overconfidence of how much being the Speaker weighs the scales, if at all. You know, if it's not your particular representative, does a Missourian know who the Speaker is and B, care, you know? And I'll also say with the Secretary of State's race, you know, that was an incredibly crowded race and Plocker more or less switched last minute. So that was always going to be an uphill battle. But, you know, that might be some of the reasons why.
Now, interestingly, the only House Speaker since Kenneth Rothman, who won Lieutenant Governor in 1980, to win anything, like any office at all, is Ron Richard, who ran unopposed for a state Senate seat in the Joplin area. Current House Speaker John Patterson may try to run for the state Senate next year, too, to try to succeed Senator Mike Searpoy in suburban Kansas City. But I guess that pathway is a little bit more difficult. That's going to be one of the most competitive races in the state, isn't it, Sarah?
Yeah, I'd argue it's probably the second most competitive race in the state Senate next year, and his path is absolutely more difficult. You know, his district is in Lee's Summit, which is a suburb of the Kansas City area, and Searpoy, who won his re-election in 2022 by 10 points, you know, in a competitive year, that could be a lot closer. So I think he does have a harder uphill climb, or not even an uphill climb, but just a very close race that I think either he or the Democratic nominee or candidate, Carrie Engle, could win.
The next curse I want to highlight is the 41.7% curse. In 2010, Democratic State Senators Wes Schumacher and Frank Barnett both lost re-election to rural state Senate seats, and their GOP opponents both got 58.3% of the vote, which it's pretty unusual for two races at the same time to get the same percentage. Since that election, Missouri Democrats have not won a Senate seat outside of the Kansas City, St. Louis, or Columbia metro areas. Sarah, Democratic malaise in rural areas is something we talk about on the show all the time, but from a legislative perspective, can you talk about what it means for Democrats to have no legislators anymore from outstate Missouri?
I mean, it means that there isn't a Democratic elected voice in that area, and it sometimes means there isn't really a choice for Democrats or for the voters. You know, roughly 30 seats were uncontested for Republicans last election, two being senators, and for Dems, it was around 18, and a lot of those, you know, uncontested seats in for Republicans were in rural areas, you know, and I think that compounds, you know, if there isn't a bench, then that means there's not going to be candidates. And that means that rural communities aren't hearing from Democrats and vice versa if they aren't seen as winnable districts.
And next year, State Representative Betsy Fogel of Springfield has the chance to break that curse. I mean, frankly, Sarah, she's seen as kind of the soft favorite in a district that is not elected a Democrat in recent memory. How much pressure is going to be on Fogel to win that seat?
Well, you remember how I just said that I thought Patterson's race was the second most competitive? I think this is the most competitive race in this next year election for Senate. You know, Senate Minority Leader Doug Beck has pretty much said that they assume they're going to win this seat, which is kind of a bold claim. I think there's more pressure on Fogel than any other Dems that are looking to flip districts this year. And I think it's because House Springfield has just creeped towards being purple, you know, the last couple of elections. Former House Minority Leader Crystal Quaid was the first of those Democrats to represent a part of Springfield in the House. There are now three Democratic reps from Springfield. I can't imagine the pressure for that. And that I do agree that I think Dems might be considered the favorite in that one. It's going to be quite a race.
The next curse involves statewide politics. A woman has never won the Missouri governorship, and it has not been for a lack of trying. Five women, Betty Hearns, Margaret Kelly, Claire McCaskill, Nicole Galloway, and Crystal Quaid, all received a major party nomination for governor and lost. Only McCaskill came close to winning, losing to Republican Matt Blunt by 3 percentage points. Sarah, this is a curse or pattern that a lot of states have yet to break, including Illinois and California, but other states are way ahead of Missouri on this front. Arizona has had 5 female governors. New Hampshire has had 4. Kansas has had 3. Arkansas just elected its first female governor. Why do you think Missouri hasn't been able to join these other places?
I mean, in part, depends on the candidates and also the party that they belong to. Forgive me if I'm wrong, Jason, but is Kelly the only Republican of that bunch that you mentioned?
Yes.
So there's an example right there of more women winning the Democratic primary compared to the Republican primary. And for Quaid and Galloway, you know, they ran at a time where Republicans just win statewide elections in Missouri. So I don't think it's the fact that they were women candidates. I think it was they were the Democrat in that instance. And, you know, it's not a surprise. You look at the Missouri House in total, the majority of Republicans in the House and Senate are white men. So it's a smaller pool for Republicans to pull those candidates in general. And you also have to remember, you know, it took until the current treasurer, Vivek Malik, for there to be a person of color in a statewide office in Missouri. So it, you know, it's kind of a pattern for the state, and we'll see how long it takes till that particular, you know, that curse was broken recently. We'll see for women being governor.
Here's a quirky non-election curse. Since 2001, nobody who has represented the St. Louis-based 4th senatorial district have served 2 full 4-year terms. So here's what happened. Lacey Clay left the Missouri Senate in 2001 to become Missouri's first district congressman. His successor, Pat Doherty, could only serve 1 additional term because of term limits. Doherty's successor, Jeff Smith, resigned after pleading guilty to lying to federal investigators. Smith's successor, Joe Kevney, won a full term in 2010 and re-election in 2014, but resigned to become an administrative law judge. His successor, Jake Hummel, lost his bid for a full term in 2018. So it's up to Senator Carla May to finally break the curse by serving until the end of next year. Sarah, I do want to get to a broader point here that A lot of lawmakers who are brushing up against term limits often seek out new opportunities before their terms are over. Why is that? Don't people love serving in the Missouri General Assembly?
I think they don't want to be caught without an opportunity at the end of their term. I think if there weren't term limits, we would see a lot less of this. And it makes sense. You know, isn't the saying the best time to look for a job is when you already have one? And so I think it kind of makes sense to have that transfer of wanting it. We'll see if it does happen with Senator May to serve the full of her term, which this will be the we're getting near the end of it there. So, yeah, we'll see if she gets there. But I think it makes kind of sense with term limits being so stringent. You know, a lot of times you could be out of your job by, you know, your 40s or 50s in that case with the legislature. And a lot of times you got to keep going.
And then there are candidates who seem to be cursed to just never win an election. In St. Louis, we have the late Bill Haas, who pretty much ran for every office imaginable before his death. Jimmy Matthews also ran for many offices, too. But interestingly, both of those men have won elections. Haas was a school board member. Matthews was on the board of aldermen. So The people I want to highlight are memorable candidates on a state level who never won. There's the late, great Chief Juana Dubey, who unsuccessfully came in third place in the 2016 Democratic primary for U.S. Senate behind Cori Bush and Jason Kander. Yes, that is actually true, by the way. And then there's Leonard Steinman, the Jefferson City legend who ran for state representative, the U.S. Senate, Congress, Jefferson City Mayor, Jefferson City Council, and also governor. Sarah, do you think some people are just cursed and will never get elected to office, or are some people just not good at running and it's not really a hex or anything like that?
I think eventually there reaches a point in someone's political career where if they haven't won an election or a statewide election, then the perception is they just aren't going to. And then the story becomes, quote, oh, this person is running again. They don't know when to quit, especially, you know, when it's consecutive years, if the candidate is running election after election after election. And then they shouldn't be taken seriously because they can't win. So I think in a way they curse themselves by kind of continuing on in the tenacity. But it can also be seen as just that candidate doesn't have what it takes to win.
Okay, Sarah, I've given you my Missouri political curses. What is one that comes to mind for you?
So mine's more recent of late, which I'm calling the appointment curse, which is if you are a former recent state senator, it might be a little harder for you to get your appointment to your board. If not, the last two that I can think of, which is Dave Schatz and Dan Hegeman, had a little bit of conflict with senators that were currently in the chamber, and that has been kind of holding things up at times. There was also, you know, Missouri's prior health director just wasn't appointed. That was the big thing. So weirdly, the governor's appointment board is considered very ceremonial and not super confrontational. And the last couple of years, it's been weaponized. So I'm going to say, you know, that's kind of a curse that we'll see if it continues into next session.
And in the last minute we have, what are some patterns or coincidences or things you're going to be looking for with 2 months away from the 2026 legislative session?
Ooh, that's a good question. I know you're talking redistricting later. I think we're going to continue to see kind of the lingering curse of that, of having that special session. I think that's going to remain. Another pattern I think we're going to continue to see, like we do every year, is tax legislation. So that could be property taxes is a big one I think they're looking into right now. And I think we're going to, again, see the curse of the end of last session. I think a lot of the animosity from Democrats in the Senate is going to roll over into the new year. You know, we didn't really see it with the special session that happened in June because there was a bigger picture of trying to get tornado relief. That I think gloves are going to be off coming in January. So it's going to be super interesting to see kind of how that curse lingers into next year.
See, we were able to fill an entire segment about curses, guys, because Sarah and I are very good at our jobs. And Sarah Kellogg is St. Louis Public Radio's State House and Politics reporter. Sarah, thank you for joining us and happy Halloween.
Of course, Jason. Happy Halloween.
When we return, we'll explain why a new congressional map aimed at helping Missouri Republicans gain a seat in the U.S. House may not be in effect in time for the 2026 election cycle, becoming a reoccurring nightmare for the GOP. And later, we'll talk with former St. Louis County Councilwoman Kelly Dunaway about how she became enchanted with witchcraft. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. I often think of myself as fairly open-minded when it comes to entertainment. But I will confess that I'm not a fan of horror films. I've never liked being in a state of perpetual terror, and bracing for some hideous beast to jump out of the darkness. But I do understand why people like the genre. Horror movies play into the fear a lot of us have of uncertainty. And for some, it's better for a film to make us feel unsettled and scared compared to being anxious about current events, the weather, or financial calamity. Yet, I believe that Missouri Republicans likely side with me lately on disliking horror movies because, and excuse the shoehorned metaphor here, their bid to redraw the state's congressional districts is becoming more and more and more and more of a logistical nightmare. The legislature's decision to pass a new map in September aimed at ousting Democratic Congressman Emanuel Cleaver sparked a flurry of lawsuits, as well as an effort to place the new redistricting plan up for a statewide vote. And GOP political consultant John Hancock explained to me that there's a lot of uncertainty about whether the new lines will be swiftly implemented.
Well, we've not been through this before, at least in my memory, which is pretty far back. And so I think we're going through something for the first time. And you've got a lot of cross currents in play. The attorney general's involved now, and then you've got multiple pieces of litigation, and you got a potential ballot initiative. So, I think my own personal opinion, Jason, is that I'll be surprised if come filing in February, if this thing is resolved in such a way that the new lines are governing.
In fact, I would go a step further. It's looking increasingly likely that the new map will not be in place in time for the 2026 midterm election cycle. And here's why. When lawmakers approved the redistricting plan last month, it did not have enough support to go into effect right away. That meant that redistricting opponents could try to gather at least 106,000 signatures by mid-December to place the proposal up for a statewide vote in November 2026. And as Richard Von Glahn of the group People Not Politicians explained, just getting the signatures would be monumentally significant.
When we turn in more than enough signatures that we will need to qualify the referendum, then the map is put on hold until there is a vote on this. The election date that we would get would be November of 2026. The General Assembly, not the governor, not the Secretary of State, the General Assembly could pass a concurrent resolution, I believe, to move that election date. But there are certain deadlines that need to be met in making sure that voters have enough time, that election authorities can do that, that our military members overseas get an opportunity to vote. So they can't just do that willy-nilly.
Von Glahn is not wrong. Moving the referendum date before filing ends on March 31st, 2026 is basically impossible, especially since state law requires roughly 10 weeks between when an election is called and when it happens. Even if the legislature rearranged heaven and earth to move the referendum date on the first day of the 2026 session in January, the earliest they could schedule an election is the middle of April. And even if it was possible to move the referendum from November 2026 to March 2026, several lawmakers I spoke with don't seem to be that interested in engaging in that highly contentious legislative maneuver. House Speaker Pro Tem Chad Perkins of Bowling Green says that having the referendum in the spring would almost guarantee a low turnout election. That would mean redistricting opponents energized against the map could have a big advantage.
I would have just my own personal opinions, right? I always prefer a larger turnout election because it gives you a better feel for what the citizens of Missouri as a whole are thinking, right? Why would you do it in March or April when you get 15-16% turnout when you could do it later on that year and get 60% turnout?
So the bottom line here is if detractors of the new map collect enough signatures, then the new lines will almost certainly not go into effect during the 2026 election cycle. This would defeat the entire crux of the National Republican redistricting push, drawing enough GOP-leaning seats to prevent the Democrats from capturing the U.S. House next year. And it's looking increasingly likely that people, not politicians, will collect enough signatures. Just this past week, the group announced that they had more than 150,000 signatures, and they still have more than a month to get more. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Doug Beck of South St. Louis County says that Republicans clearly miscalculated about how much public opposition there was to the redistricting plan.
And people want to fight back, and they're tired. They're tired of this power grab. It's just a blatant power grab. They're tired of people. They're tired of the Republican Party cheating and changing the rules in the middle of the game.
Perhaps the only hope among Republicans is that Secretary of State Denny Hoskins and Attorney General Catherine Hanaway place enough roadblocks to prevent the referendum from going to voters. Hanaway filed a lawsuit in federal court contending that a referendum unconstitutionally yanks the right to redraw districts away from the legislature. And Hoskins is saying that signatures gathered before mid-October won't count toward the final tally.
According to my interpretation, Missouri's referendum process is outlined clearly in the Constitution as well as state statute, and signatures collected before official approval are invalid and should not count toward the legal requirement.
Now, it should be noted that officials with People Not Politicians strongly dispute what Hoskins said there, and they're fighting in court to make sure that roughly 100,000 signatures gathered before October 15th count. Chuck Hatfield, an attorney with People Not Politicians, says that both Hanaway and Hoskins' maneuvers are desperate.
I think the whole thing's outrageous. I think we have state officials in a full-blown tantrum about the right of the people to overrule these congressional districts, which the people are guaranteed in the Constitution.
Hatfield also took major issue with a news release from Hoskins' office implying that gathering signatures before a referendum proposal was approved could bring about criminal penalties.
That is ridiculous. I've sent two emails and left two voicemails with the Secretary of State's Deputy General Counsel saying, tell me what statute would make it a crime and I will advise my client accordingly. No response, because there is no such statute. This is blatant attempts to intimidate and to deny people, not politicians, and the folks Richard's working with, their right to petition their government.
Hoskins eventually walked back from that contention. In any case, this festering discord about the future of the redistricting plan is prompting some introspection among Missouri Republicans. State Representative Bryant Wolfen is a St. Genevieve Republican who voted against the redistricting plan. He says that before the special session began, he didn't know that putting the map up for a statewide vote was even possible.
And I guarantee the majority of the caucus did not as well. Did leadership? I really don't know about leadership. I don't know if it was really thought that far in advance. You know, to be honest, it was kind of rushed down. Obviously, I think it's pretty clear that most of this came from the federal level. And you know, I'm not going to sit here and preach on what did and what didn't, because I wasn't involved in those conversations. But I think just given how fast all this was kind of rushed through.
What Wolfen is alluding to is how President Donald Trump and his administration have been pressuring GOP-leaning states like Missouri to redraw their districts ahead of next year's election cycle. He says the complications over implementing the new map should provide pause to his colleagues about taking orders from the federal government.
Don't just listen to what they're doing at the federal level. Don't you, you know, we are sovereign states. We are independent states. We are allowed to be able to voice our own opinions. And we can we certainly do not have to pander to what they need at the federal level. You know, look at the whole picture.
But others like Senate President Pro Tem Cindy O'Loughlin were not surprised that Democrats in particular were fighting back against the map with lawsuits and the referendum.
I mean, people understand that the number of representatives that you have in Washington can make a huge difference. And, you know, I guess I don't have to remind you or really anybody listening to this, the current environment, everything is war. So I'm not surprised when, you know, shots start getting fired.
Interestingly, O'Loughlin and other Republicans I talked to haven't really gotten much direct blowback from their constituents. She says she has no regrets about pushing the map through the Senate, which included using a parliamentary maneuver to end a Democratic filibuster.
You know, you can't bring a knife to a gunfight. And I think that's why people ultimately said, well, we need to at least try to do whatever we can to maintain the majority. Now, if it were, you know, some other topics that we just couldn't agree on, but kind of we were sort of close, it wouldn't take on such a radical feel. But the people in Washington in the Democrat Party are radicals.
State Representative Jim Murphy of South St. Louis County also doesn't regret voting for the new map, even though he conceded it wasn't particularly high on his priority list.
Well, I wish I hadn't had to vote for it, but I don't regret my vote, no. I mean, I see what other states have done, and it's appalling. Tit for tat is not a good way to run a state or a country, for that matter. But unfortunately, it's the environment we're in.
If voters do decide on the fate of the new map next November, Republicans are somewhat optimistic that it will be approved and then be in effect for the 2028 election cycle. After all, Missouri Republicans have basically won every statewide election since 2016 and hold commanding majorities in the Missouri General Assembly. But Hancock, the GOP consultant, says his fellow Republicans should not get complacent, especially since Democratic groups are pouring a lot of money into the referendum effort. People Not Politicians has raised nearly $3 million in large donations since September, and the Democratic National Committee has promised money and organizational manpower to help get the referendum over the finish line.
Somebody's going to need to put some money behind it, though, because the voters' natural inclination in Missouri is to vote no. And so you'd have to have enough resources behind it to get the message out to communicate to the GOP voters that, hey, we got to go vote for this map, you know. And I'm not saying there's no funding for it, but I'm not aware of any funding for it.
All of this uncertainty points to one thing. Mid-decade redistricting was a lot more complicated than Missouri Republicans thought it would be. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk with former St. Louis County Councilwoman Kelly Dunaway about how she became enchanted with witchcraft. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Kelly Dunaway spent close to 5 years as a member of the St. Louis County Council, and it was not a particularly enjoyable time to serve on the seven-person body. The Chesterfield Democrat had to take hard and, to some people, unpopular votes on COVID mitigation policies, and she became ensnared in the seemingly never-ending struggle between the county council and the county executive. But those days are over for Dunaway, who stepped aside at the end of last year. And since leaving St. Louis County politics, Dunaway started Legal Witchcraft. It's a company that offers folks a chance to use spells, crystals, herbs, and ritual to overcome obstacles and to summon empowerment. While witchcraft has always had a controversial place in American society, it's also become more popular over the past couple of years among women who seek camaraderie and self-fulfillment. And with the help of social media and the modern political environment, Dunaway is almost certainly not alone in embracing witchcraft. Dunaway joins us in studio to discuss legal witchcraft and the place of witchcraft in American society. Kelly, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Jason. It's great to be here.
Let's start off with a basic question. What is witchcraft?
Witchcraft is an empowered state where we are in connection with the universe, plants, crystals, other people, any living thing. I see myself as a piece of stardust that has been flung throughout the universe and has existed since before time and will exist after time. And my work here is to reconnect with that inner power that comes with that piece of stardust and to share it and with other people and to bring them into the fold.
If I came to legal witchcraft, what sort of things would I get to experience? And more importantly, do I have to be a lawyer to take advantage of your services?
You do not have to be a lawyer, though many of my clients are. And whether we're getting together for a tarot reading or we're participating in a moon ritual, whether it's one-on-one or in community with others, what we're doing is finding words to put to what it is you truly want in your life. And once you have the words for it, we will turn it into an affirmation that you can say every day in the mirror, to your friends, to the people around you, so that you remind yourself all the time what it is that you really want. And my goal is to get you not just to say it out loud, but to take that first step into action. There's the thing you want, and now you have to go get it. And to me, that is my job in legal witchcraft, is to empower you to admit out loud what it is that you want and then get you into action to go after it.
That is actually very similar to what you recently wrote on your Substack, and I'm going to quote you here. "Believe me, I wish I could say what I want, light a candle, and sit back and wait for it to happen. But naming it is just the first step. Adding magic follows, and the next step, the most critical step, takes courage. It's the act of moving past our fear of failure that lights the fire of our first action." I'm sure that both witches and non-witches have had to do exactly as you described on a semi-daily basis, which is facing a situation that is scary, or is difficult, or is unfamiliar. How does adding the ritual of witchcraft help create the confidence to take that first action?
Because it reconnects us to this power that was always ours to begin with, but a power that we've been taught by society, by the patriarchy, especially women, to ignore our intuition and our compassion and these things inside of us and around us that make us so powerful, but that we have tuned out of because we've been taught to not take care of ourselves, to not trust ourselves, to not trust each other. And this is an opportunity to put all of that back where it's supposed to be, to light this empowering piece of power within all of us to go after the life we want.
Do you consider witchcraft a religion? Because if I recall correctly, in the 20th century, there was something called Wicca that became fairly popular at certain points. But from doing research, Wicca is not every aspect of witchcraft.
I see Wicca as to witchcraft as like Catholicism is to Christianity. It's a sect of witchcraft. And would I say it's a religion? I mean, depends on who you ask and who's defining it. It's a co-creative relationship with the universe and nature and the power that exists around and between us all of the time. I don't see like one divine being that's in charge, but just a co-creation between me and the rest of the stardust that's all around.
In fact, I think one of the reasons why the concept of witchcraft has been so controversial, especially among Christians, is it seems to firmly reject the idea that there is an external deity that is guiding everything, and that really a lot of the power for people comes from within. Am I getting that correctly?
Yes, you nailed it.
And can you explain like how that is so much different than like a lot of contemporary religious thought?
I mean, this is just my personal opinion, but a lot of contemporary religious thought is, I tell you what is moral and you do it. Or if you don't do it, then you will be punished somehow. And in my view of the world, it's all about karma. Whatever you put out into the universe is what the universe gives back. If you wake up angry and you take your anger out on people, good things are not going to happen to you throughout the day. But if you wake up, no matter how you feel, and you put a smile on your face and you just work through it, you're going to get good things that come back to you. It's because we are all in a symbiotic relationship with the world and the universe around us. And it's a give and take, love and be loved, hate and be hated world.
How large of a witchcraft community does St. Louis have?
It is much bigger than I ever imagined. I mean, I met your producer in a tarot class at Sincerely the Craft.
My Norfleet, by the way. Is it okay that okay, I wanted to make sure it was okay to expose that.
I know,
continue.
I outed you too. Sorry about that. But I think, and then you see people, you know, went to tarot class. I went through three versions of it. So like 101, 201. I mean, I've been through advanced tarot. And I think looking at even the posts on social media that are generating from St. Louis, the authors in St. Louis who are witches, and like the Wicca festival and the witchcraft festivals that come through here are extraordinary.
And what is tarot card reading for people who may not understand what that is?
So the tarot is a deck of cards. There are 78 cards, 78, 22, and 7. Yeah, there are 78 cards in the tarot deck. And I see the tarot as a mirror. So I can throw down a combination of cards, and I could throw them down for you, Jason. And what I will tell you what the cards mean, what the position that they're in means. But what really is important is that you connect with them at some place inside of you. It's like Jung's archetypes, right? It's connecting to a piece of yourself that maybe you don't see in your everyday conscious, but I help you tap into so that you can make decisions about how to move forward.
And to bring this into politics for a second, there was a burgeoning controversy in the 1980s about Nancy Reagan not using tarot cards, but using, I guess, astrology or psychics to, I guess, maybe maneuver through her day. I think there's been a lot of examples throughout history of people using that type of thing to make political decisions. Has that been your understanding as well?
Well, yes. And I say that because it's a tool to create intentionality, right? You read your horoscope, whether you believe in it or not, it still gives you a guidance for how to get through your day or your week or your month, what energies are available to you to capitalize on and to push yourself forward through. It's just a tool, in my view. I mean, I think it's a powerful tool and I believe in it. But even if you don't, it's a powerful tool for taking ownership over your life and the direction of each day.
We're talking with Kelly Dunaway, a former St. Louis County Councilwoman and the proprietor of Legal Witchcraft. So, Kelly, I have to ask this question. When did you realize that you were a witch?
So it was a remembering is how I like to put it. And it happened during the pandemic because when the days got long and dark and lonely, I leaned into the quiet and leaned deeper and deeper into myself. And that is where that spark first started to shine. And I decided to write novels, and I decided that my protagonist was going to be a witch. And the more I got to learn about witchcraft, and she's an ancient witch, you know, first century BCE. But the more I got to learn about modern witchcraft and what it means and who's involved and how far and deep and wide it goes, I felt like I found my place and my people and what I was here to do.
And you came out of the broom closet, so to speak. See, I promised there would be witch puns in this interview. After you left St. Louis County politics, even in a very democratic place like St. Louis County, did you fear that being open about being a witch would have been a bridge too far?
Oh, my gosh. So when I look back now, Jason, I kind of laugh and I'm like, maybe I should have, just to create such a storm. But I just feel like it would have been the only thing anybody was talking about in St. Louis County. No one would have taken me seriously. I wouldn't have been able to do the work that I was able to get done, even in that trying situation.
And I ask this because there's a pretty recent example in politics and witchcraft commingling. Back in 2010, Christine O'Donnell, who was the Republican Senate nominee for Delaware, had to create this ad to respond to prior comments she made to Bill Maher, of all people, about dabbling in witchcraft.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you. None of us are perfect, but none of us can be happy with what we see all around us. Politicians who think spending, trading favors, and backroom deals are the ways to stay in office. I'll go to Washington and do what you'd do. I'm Christine O'Donnell, and I approve this message. I'm you.
Unfortunately for Christine O'Donnell, she did not become a U.S. senator. She lost by almost 20 percentage points. And there were a lot of reasons why she lost. But the fact that she once said she was a witch played a pretty big role. You're a former Barack Obama staffer, so you're a grizzled veteran of the late 2000s, early 2010s politics. You probably remember that. I'm sure you have some thoughts on that as a witch as well.
Well, I have to say, Jason, I'm ashamed to admit that I laughed when that whole thing happened. I laughed out loud a lot. And now that I am a witch and I call myself a witch openly, I feel kind of bad for her because she couldn't be who she is authentically and survive in politics, which, as you just read from my recent Substack post, neither could I. And I as a witch now and as a proud witch, part of why I use that word is because it is mired in so much of its own hate and backstory and history that was just used to justify the relentless chasing and murdering of women who lived in their own empowerment before it was allowed.
You transition nicely to my next question, which was going to be what you just referred to, the Salem witch trials, because Puritans associated witchcraft with Satanism, the devil, and just bad, dark, nasty stuff. What you seem to be talking about is not that. I'm not going to argue that everybody is going to embrace it after listening to this interview. But why do you think there's a disconnect between the contemporary view of witchcraft and the type of things that legal witchcraft provides?
I think it's, you know, I think it's society justifying treating women who are not following in the footsteps of what society wants women to be. And I don't mean all of society. I mean a big, loud piece of it. But I am never going to be the person that that piece of society wants me to be. I am divorced. I live alone. I talk to plants. I sit in nature and meditate. Because I am connected to my own power, not the power that the patriarchy wants to withhold from me and so many other women. It's this magic that we have inside of ourselves that I want everyone to be able to tap into. And I'm not saying that witchcraft is just for women. I think the perfect situation is a yin and a yang, 50% feminine energy, 50% masculine energy in each and every human being. And until we can bridge that gap and be open to and love each parts of ourselves that make up the whole, we're never going to move forward as a society or as St. Louis County or anything else. And that is part of what I want to do in my work with Legal Witchcraft, is to help all of us tap into that feminine power that we all contain.
Atmos Magazine reported that there are more than 8 million posts on TikTok with the hashtag WitchTalk. In that same article, Alice Tarbuck is quoted as saying, surging interest in witchcraft is, quote, always simultaneous to a down surge in quality of life, an upsurge in right-wing persecution, and heightened scarcity. What do you think about Tarbuck's comments?
I think it's right, because the more the right wing gains power, the more rights and privileges are taken primarily away from women. And it's a way for us to turn towards something that gives us back into our power, gives us a way back into our power, and also connects us to each other. One of my clients who participated in a moon ritual recently mentioned at the height of the magical moment that if more women got together in rooms like this and got this vulnerable and tapped into this much power, that the old systems would crumble. And I think this is what's happening, is women are seeing ourselves in 2025 losing our rights, losing our ability to succeed. Women are fleeing from the workplace because we can't – the workplace is trying to rein back in the freedoms we got during the pandemic. And I think we're just trying to find a power and a place that's rooted in something different from – politics and hate and scarcity.
What are you hoping that people get out of witchcraft if they learn it through you or through others?
Just to be empowered, to be authentic, to connect to the magic that's all around in nature and the universe, and connect it to what's inside of you so that you can build the life that you want.
I guess a couple of rapid-fire questions, maybe to dispel some popular myths about witchcraft. If I had an enemy that I wanted to turn into a frog, is there anything for me that you could provide me to do that?
So not me personally. I do hear that the witches of Etsy do have such spells that can go in that route, but I am very focused on putting out into the universe what I'm going to get back.
Have you also found that men are interested in witchcraft, and do they have to be called warlocks, or could they be witches if they wanted to?
I have met men who are witches. They call themselves witches. They are witches. I tend to find most men, not to dissuade heterosexual men, but most of the men who are engaged with me, at least, are LGBTQ.
You mentioned moon rituals several times. What is a moon ritual, and how does it help some of your clients deal with some of the things they're dealing with?
So I tend to do new moon rituals and full moon rituals. In the full moon ritual, we're usually releasing something that's holding us back. It could be an outdated relationship or a person or a job or just a negative way we talk to ourselves. And in that ritual, we will name the thing that's holding us back. We'll set it on fire. We'll share. We'll talk about what it looks like and feels like to live without that. And then the goal is to have everybody commit to one action item of something that they're going to do that they wouldn't have previously done because that thing was holding them back. In a new moon ritual, it's about new beginnings and starting new things. And so we usually in those, we will name the thing that we want to achieve in the next 6 months. And then we create magic around it and shared vulnerability to it creates accountability, because once you say you want something out loud and a room full of people hear you say it, you're going to be motivated to actually go after that thing. And now you've got this support system that's there to support you while you're doing it. You've got the magic. You've got the crystals. Everybody leaves with a little bag of goodies to hang on to during their journey. And it just creates this opportunity to see and feel what could be so that you then are motivated to go out after it.
Kelly Dunaway is a former St. Louis County Councilwoman and the proprietor of Legal Witchcraft. Kelly, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jason. I really didn't think you'd have me back when I left politics. So it's great to be here.
Well, you did promise me your first extended interview after you came out of the broom closet, and I'm glad we could follow through on that.
The Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air is produced by Jason Rosenbaum, Alex Hoyer, Emily Woodbury, Danny Wisentowski, Maya Norfleet, and Elaine Cha. Audio engineering and sound design by Aaron Dorr. The politics editor is Fred Ehrlich.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.